to Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 48, The X-Ray Man. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to discuss the incredible life of Walter Dodd, the man who rose from the ranks as a janitor at Harvard Medical School to develop cutting-edge technology and earn his place as the father of American radiology. Though, as you will hear, his journey was not without great personal sacrifice. But before we talk about X-rays, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is October 2nd. 3 tense weeks after the September 11th attacks, Governor Jane Swift addressed the people of Massachusetts on October 2nd, 2001, to discuss the new security measures the Commonwealth would adopt. Good evening. 3 weeks ago today, a vicious terrorist attack changed our world. As we continue to grieve for those lost, we are beginning to understand the new realities facing our nation and our Commonwealth. Tonight I want to speak with you about the steps state government has taken and will take to prepare for the weeks and months ahead. In those early days, there was a strong focus on airport security as well as general terror prevention. The governor announced a massive deployment of the state police to guard bridges, tunnels, airports, reservoirs, and other potential targets. The formation of a state police anti-terrorism unit that would coordinate with the Joint Terrorism Task Force. A new director of Commonwealth Security to work with the new National Department of Homeland Security. A request that airport security be nationalized. Using state police and National Guard for airport security in the short term. And free tuition at state schools for the Massachusetts children and spouses of victims.
The orders from George Washington's Cambridge headquarters on October 3, 1775, include a prohibition on popular games of chance. Any officer, non-commissioned officer, or soldier who shall hereafter be detected playing at toss-up, pitch and hustle, or any other games of chance in or near the camp and villages bordering on the encampments shall, without delay, be confined and punished for disobedience of orders. The general does not mean, by the above order, to discourage sports of exercise and recreation. He only means to discountenance and punish gaming. So we know the troops were gambling, and that the general wasn't happy about it. But what were toss-up and pitch and hustle? Historian J.L. Bell teased it out in a 2009 article. Toss-up is almost disappointingly simple. It was simply flipping a coin and betting on the outcome. Pitch and hustle sounds a little more fun. Pitch meant that the players would pitch pennies at a mark in the dirt. Whoever was closest to the mark would be the first to hustle, then the second closest, and so on. Hustling meant that all the pennies would be picked up and put into a hat. The first player who had won the pitch would shake the hat and turn it upside down on the ground. They would keep any coins that came out heads and put the rest back into the hat. The second player would then repeat the process and keep any heads, and then the hat would keep passing until all the coins were gone. It's not exactly Texas Hold'em, but it probably helped pass the time.
Wednesday is October 4th. On October 4th, 1960, Eastern Airlines Flight 375 took off from Logan Airport, bound for Philadelphia, Charlotte, and Atlanta. The aircraft was a Lockheed L-188 Electra with four turboprop engines carrying 67 passengers and a crew of five. The plane took off at 5:40 p.m. and 6 seconds later collided with a huge flock of starlings. Birds were sucked into three of the engines and the aircraft lost power. It quickly rolled over and crashed in shallow water about 500 feet from shore. Fishing boats rushed to the crash site and picked up eight passengers and two flight attendants who had been thrown from the plane on impact. They would be the only survivors. Meanwhile, volunteers on shore formed a human chain to reach the plane. They worked frantically, searching for more survivors among the mud and wreckage, but found only bodies. 62 people were killed, including 15 Marine Corps recruits on their way to basic training at Parris Island, and a group who had been attending a shoe convention in Boston. It was one of the largest mass casualty events since the 1942 fire at Coconut Grove, leading the Winthrop Police Department to be converted into a morgue. It was the second Electra crash in 3 weeks, though no one was killed in the earlier crash at LaGuardia. There would be five fatal accidents involving the Electra between September 1959 and September 1961, which would lead the plane to be phased out. Future turboprop and jet engines would be designed to be more resilient to bird strikes. Despite the obvious human tragedy, News coverage in the week following the strike devoted a surprising amount of space to a secret document that had allegedly been lost during the crash. Thanks to the AP wire service, this story was picked up by papers as far away as The Age in Melbourne, Australia, which ran this version. A mysterious document was missing today in the aftermath of the crash of an Eastern Airlines Lockheed Electra in Boston Harbor, with a heavy loss of life. The Federal Bureau of Investigation refused to comment on a police report that it had taken over the phase of the inquiry relating to the document. Existence of the unidentified secret document became known late last night. Captain Carl Larson, state police officer in charge of rescue operations at the scene, said he was informed of it by a member of the Office of Special Investigations, a branch of the U.S. Air Force. Captain Larson said he was told the document had been aboard the plane at takeoff and was later missing. He said the Federal Bureau of Investigation started a search for the document and an investigation of its disappearance. An official of the OSI at the airport, Thomas L. Hackett, admitted his organization was looking for something important, but said it was not top secret. An airline spokesman said that the FBI had made inquiries at Eastern's Boston office. There is no public record that the mysterious document was ever found, or what it was.
John Adams had the reputation of being an incredibly strict and demanding father. He held his children to what many consider to be unrealistic standards. Consider, however, the standards to which he held himself, seen here in his diary entry as a young student on October 5, 1758. I have read about 10 pages in Justinian and translated about 4 pages into English. This is the whole of my day's work. I have smoked, chatted, trifled, loitered away this whole day almost. But much the greatest part of this day has been spent in unloading a cart, in cutting oven wood, in making and recruiting my own fire, in eating nuts and apples, in drinking tea, cutting and smoking tobacco, and in chatting with the doctor's wife at their house and at this. Chores, chat, tobacco, tea, steal away time. But I am resolved to translate Justinian and his commentator's notes by daylight and read Gilbert's tenures by night till I am master of both, and I will meddle with no other book in this chamber on a weekday. On a Sunday, I will read the Inquiry into the Nature of the Human Soul, and for amusement, I will sometimes read Ovid's Art of Love to Mrs. Sable. This shall be my method. I have read Gilbert's first section of Feuds this evening, but am not a master of it.
Friday is October 6th, and on October 6th, 1962, disaster struck the Green Line. The Metropolitan Transit Authority's annual report sets the stage. On October 4th, the barest trace of a storm began to show itself, and on the following day, Friday, October 5th, a sizable 1.93 inches of rain was dumped on Boston. This was only the beginning, because on Saturday, October 6th, an inundating 3 inches of rainfall swept over Greater Boston. As a side note, some communities in Texas got over 51 inches of rainfall during Hurricane Harvey. Judging by how the T reacted to about 5 inches of rain, we'd be in real trouble if that ever happened here. As the muddy river overflowed its banks, water streamed down the incline into nearby Green Line tunnels, where it reached 7 feet deep in places. The report continues. Operation into and out of Kenmore Square, a vital location in the system, was knocked out with deadly effectiveness. Simultaneously, 4 major surface routes feeding through this pivotal location went out of business. Nothing moved on the Highland Branch Line, the Brighton-Newton-Watertown streetcar route, the Commonwealth Avenue Line, and the Beacon Street operation. For us modern listeners, that's the B, C, D, and former A lines. Meanwhile, in the Kenmore Square subway, through which all of these surface lines operate, flooding conditions worsened by the hour. On stretches of the Highland Branch, the water level rose to engulf the trucks of the vehicles. It was this very condition that brought local firefighters and police representatives to the scene, and using rowboats, they helped rescue scores of passengers marooned on the vehicles. The Green Line was out of service for over a week. T-workers sandbagged tunnel entrances to prevent more water from streaming in, while giant pumps helped clear the water that had already accumulated along the lines. This flooding would be repeated in 1996, but the recent construction project that daylighted the muddy river is meant to prevent future occurrences by improving drainage.
After General Thomas Gage, Royal Governor of Massachusetts, used the hated Massachusetts Government Act to dissolve the Great and General Court of the province during their annual legislative session in the fall of 1774, the members of the court rebelled. The delegates, including such notables as John Adams, Joseph Warren, John Hancock, Benjamin Church, and Samuel Adams, laid out their grievances, then voted on a resolution on October 7, 1774, that would change the course of Massachusetts history. Upon a motion, made and seconded, voted that the members aforesaid do now resolve themselves into a provincial congress, to be joined by such other persons as have been or shall be chosen for that purpose, to take into consideration the dangerous and alarming situation of public affairs in this province, and to consult and determine on such measures as they shall judge, will tend to promote the true interest of His Majesty, and the peace, welfare, and prosperity of the province. The Massachusetts Provincial Congress set itself up as the revolutionary shadow government in the province. The members adjourned to Concord and began what is recognized as the first autonomous government in the colonies, free of crown influence. They began stockpiling arms and supplies and urging town militias to drill for war. The Provincial Congress led Massachusetts through the tumultuous early years of the Revolutionary War, finally dissolving itself after Massachusetts adopted its constitution in 1780.
Finally, Sunday is October 8th. In 1875, a woman named Margaret Bingham was murdered in her home in East Boston. Some hours later, her mother went down to the cellar to fetch some firewood and found Margaret. According to the Globe, the body was drenched in blood and so covered with coal dust and gravel as to be hardly recognizable, the face being terribly scratched and the nose badly damaged by a blow from some iron instrument. Her entire body was bruised from head to foot, and around her neck the prints of fingers were plainly visible. The mouth of the murdered woman was found filled with gravel, and one pebble the size of a walnut had been forced down as far as the epiglottis. A few days later, a man by the name of George Pemberton tried to use Margaret's rings to pay for liquor in a bar in Salem. He was quickly arrested and soon convicted, despite his attempt to claim that his heavy drinking meant that he couldn't remember the crime and thus shouldn't be found culpable. On October 8, 1875, Pemberton went to the gallows. After the reading of the warrant, Pemberton stood up, the chair was placed back, and he awaited his doom without one shudder or visible movement. Dr. Lorimer then offered a brief, fervent prayer, commending the soul of the guilty man to his Maker. Sheriff Clark, almost as pale as the condemned, advanced to the front of the platform and said, "In pursuance of the foregoing warrant, I now proceed to execute the law." And with the utterance of the last word, pressed his foot upon the spring, and the body of the luckless wretch shot through the trap door and hung dangling in the air. The spring was touched at precisely 10:03, and less than a second later, life was extinct, the neck being broken instantly by the fall. The rope, on becoming taut, caused the body to rebound and quiver for a second or two, but beyond this there was no motion, and none that indicated pain. The body swung for some little time and then hung perfectly motionless. Thousands of people showed up to watch Pemberton die, but only 350 ticket holders were admitted. In 1875, an execution was considered a perfectly wholesome form of public entertainment, even in Boston.
Now let's turn to our main topic. Boston has been a leader in scientific discovery and innovation ever since the first Resurrection Man began digging up cadavers for ambitious medical students. The fields of medicine, anatomy, and forensics all experienced significant advancements right here in Boston. Today, our discussion will focus on Walter Dodd, a pioneer in the field of radiology. Dodd was born in England in 1869. His father was a stage carpenter for a theater, and he was raised in a world of artistry and creativity that helped form what would later be characterized as an agreeable and charming personality. Things took a turn at age 10, when he immigrated to America to live under the care of his sister. He was a very bright student, attending public schools, but due to his economic circumstances, was unable to finish high school. At age 14, he began a four-year stint with a firm of coffee and tea merchants. Dodd, however, dreamed of a life at sea. An article from the American Journal of Rentgenology describes how his career as a sailor was blown off course. It was his attractive personality, writes his biographer, that led to his next employment and onto the major activity of his life. In 1887, his Sunday school teacher, in whom he found a friend as well, on learning that young Dodd's aspiration for a life at sea were strongly opposed by his sister, recommended the lad to her cousin, the late President Eliot of Harvard University. Dr. Eliot added his power of dissuasion and, in addition, obtained for Dodd the post of assistant janitor in the Boylston Chemical Laboratory at the college in Cambridge.
One professor remarked years later that he was the best janitor we ever had, the only disadvantage being that he was so much too good for the place that we knew we must lose him soon. In addition to cleaning, Dodd's janitorial duties included setting up the classrooms for student experiments. Because they liked him, and because they wanted to keep him in the job, the professors allowed Dodd to participate in the experiments and lectures. He essentially audited a chemistry degree, even taking and passing the exams. In 1894, he takes the state exam to become a registered pharmacist, and is appointed chief apothecary at Mass General. As an apothecary, he prepared drugs and chemicals, recommended treatments, experimented with new compounds, and took official photos for the hospital. That may seem a bit odd, but photography required a lot of specialized knowledge in those days. With this background in chemistry and photography, he was uniquely interested when, in November 1895, word came in that a German scientist named Wilhelm Röntgen had taken a picture of the bones in his wife's hand using newly discovered rays cast by a special vacuum tube. To understand the enormity of this advancement, you have to imagine what surgery was like before the development of medical imaging. Imagine finding and extracting a bullet if the surgeon would just start at the entry wound and cut a little bit, then probe a little bit, cut a little bit more, and keep repeating until he happened to probe the bullet. Imagine a world where every broken bone was diagnosed, classified, and set entirely by touch.
Within a year, Dodd is able to produce an X-ray. We'll include a link in the show notes to an article that explains the process in detail, but it's quite dry if induction coils aren't your thing. At the time, there was no instrumentation, so the operator would calibrate an X-ray machine by checking an image of their hand. Unfortunately, the link between radiation and cancer wasn't recognized. Almost immediately, Dodd was struck with a series of painful, mysterious ailments starting in November of 1896, when he was hospitalized with a dermatitis similar to a bad sunburn. Over the next several years, it comes and goes and gradually gets worse. He has several brand new treatments, including a skin graft in 1897, followed by 14 more, and aspirin starting as soon as it hits the market in 1899. Of these early injuries, biographer John Macy writes, Dodd himself did not suspect the gravity of his injuries. Though he endured untellable torments, he made light of his sufferings. The burns would get well. It may be that he really thought his injuries were superficial and temporary, or it may be that he was practicing a little self-deception. It was the only deception that he ever practiced, for in spite of his courageous candor in facing facts, he never lost a slightly superstitious optimism about himself. And he was confirmed in his faith that things would come out all right by the number of times that he recovered, when by all the rules, a weaker man would have succumbed. Whether reckless or innocently unaware of the risks he was running, he certainly did not spare himself. As soon as pain abated and he could use his hands, he was back with his precious machine. Mr. Godso recalls that, as a matter of course, before they went to bed, they washed their hands in zinc oxide solution and wrapped them up in cloths. Often, when pain made sleep impossible, Dodd would walk the floor of the pharmacy all night with his hand above his head.
Despite the pain, and we have to imagine some suspicion of the cause, Dodd pressed on, dedicating himself wholly to science. While the skin grafts did relieve some discomfort, by 1902, he had tumors in his fingers that required his first amputation. From October 1902 to June 1905, a dozen or more operations, consisting of partial amputations and excisions of growing ulcerations and kinetoses, were performed. At the end of this journey, he is pain-free and without bandages. For the first 10 years of this work, through 1906, Dodd refined the equipment and techniques of what is still known as radiography. However, as a radiographer, he was still considered subservient to the surgeon. Not one to play second fiddle, he enrolled at Harvard Medical School. However, he was so sought after for his knowledge that his fame hindered his studies. To obtain balance, Dodd retreated to the University of Vermont and graduated in 1908. Dr. Dodd returns to Boston and becomes a roentgenologist, or what we'd call a radiologist today, at Mass General, a peer to every surgeon in the hospital. In 1909, he's appointed as the first professor of radiology at Harvard Medical School. Simultaneously, he develops a private practice on Beacon Street. In 1915, Dr. Dodd volunteered to serve in France with the Harvard Medical Unit in World War I. He had additional surgery on his arm and chest to prepare for the strenuous work, and convalesced during the ocean voyage. Upon his arrival, he refused any special accommodation. Undoubtedly, this new technology and his presence in the field saved lives. In mass casualty situations, he wouldn't even make plates. He would just check the soldier in front of his fluoroscope and mark where the surgeon should cut.
After 5 months in France, Dodd returns and contracts a severe pulmonary infection secondary to lung cancer in the summer of 1916, which isn't diagnosed until after his death that December. In his will, he left $100 to inspire others to fund the Mass General X-ray Department. The story of Walter Dodd's life is, in some ways, a pretty grotesque tale, with over 50 surgeries endured. But it's also incredibly inspirational. As someone who is expected to become nothing better than the lowest of sailors, his intelligence, curiosity, and innovation led him to become one of the pillars of modern American medicine.
To learn more about Dr. Walter J. Dodd, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/048. We'll have a link to the journal article detailing Dodd's early experiments and an image of his X-ray tube. We'll also post a portrait of Dr. Dodd in which he tucks his hand in his jacket like Napoleon. He would regularly take that pose to hide his amputations. And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries. Since we last shared listener feedback, we got another great comment about episode 44 on perambulating the bounds. Dear Jack and Nikki, my name is Jake, but I'll let that slide. Just wanted to say how much I enjoyed your podcast on perambulating the bounds and my brief story. Probably in 1990, the late Boston City Councilor David Skondras was given the task of perambulating the bounds as punishment. I don't remember why. David, making pear juice out of pears, a pun to the Dorchester-created clap pear, made the task a Boston history lesson. He rented a bus, printed out maps and pictures, and around 30 of us went all over Boston and environs. Locals knowledgeable on Boston spoke, and very interestingly, so did some of the DPW engineers who actually perambulated. 25 years later, when possible, I like traveling to border areas, whether cities, Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, or the boundary marker in Williamstown for Massachusetts, Vermont, and New York. Sean D., who writes from Arlington, Virginia, but is originally from Dorchester.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. And if you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. As I've said before, it is the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show about the hidden history of Chinatown.